Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke.
All right, guys, good morning. It's Saturday, the 12th of September, 2009. This is Solder Smoke 115, Solder Smoke 115. Let's see, got kind of an anniversary, milestone kind of theme for this show. It just seemed to work out that way. And I'll start out with a little bit of kind of Italy travelogue, Italy history, Italian design kind of story here. That's, as you'll see, apropos of the kind of anniversary theme. I have one of these annual anniversaries coming up for myself, not an anniversary, a birthday. And it just, by coincidence, I received some email from one of our esteemed listeners who, he will remain unnamed, but expressed some concern about the passing of time and, you know, getting older and all that. And I reminded him that we're all getting older at the same rate. It also brought to mind something I read in the newspaper here not long ago. We live very close to St. Peter's Basilica in Vatican City. Amazing place, really beautiful. And the history of the project is also very interesting. Great book out on how St. Peter's Basilica was constructed. But what I found interesting was that Michelangelo, who did quite a bit of the work on the project, he didn't start work on St. Peter's until he was 70. That's when he got his start on the project. And he worked on it for almost 20 years. So I guess the message here is for a lot of us, maybe we're just getting started, or maybe we're quite a few years away from our really big project. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. A little bit more of Italian travelogue. I think I told you in the last episode about our problems with the wild boar, with the cinghiali. And I told you about how Billy and I had attempted to camp out, but because of the wild boar, we had kind of bailed out of the camping attempt. Well, I'm happy to report that we went back out the following weekend, and we basically said, the heck with the cinghiali. They better watch out for us. They better worry about us. We're not going to worry about them. And we proceeded to camp out in the close in the front yard of the country place we have out there. Now, Billy slept like a rock. I slept fairly well because I was sleeping on a rock. not too well. And my wife, who was in the nearby apartment, was worried about the cinghiali getting us, and she didn't sleep a wink. So it was only a marginally successful camping trip, but Billy got a real kick out of it, and I was glad that we faced the dangers of the Italian countryside. It's now hunting season for the cinghiali. And so I suspect that day by day or night by night, we have we have less to worry about, or fewer of them to worry about anyway. All right. Hey, continuing with our anniversary theme, I came across, I love this magazine, Air and Space, by the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, quarterly magazine, really, really quality work. And you know, in almost every issue, I come across something where it causes me kind of sit back and say, well, I hadn't thought about that, or look at something a little bit different. And recently they had an article in there that just noted the number of years between the first powered flight of the Wright brothers and the first lunar landing. In other words, how long did it take aviation to go from Orville and Wilbur to Neil Armstrong stepping onto the moon? Just 60 years, 60. So, man, that's quite a leap for mankind there, you know? And I just didn't, it never occurred to me that that such a short period had passed from the wooden and canvas of the Wright Flyer to Apollo 11. So, well, three cheers for us. Yeah. let me see what else we have. Let me continue on the anniversary theme. Slashdot noted that we recently had the 40th anniversary of the Internet. I think it was on September 2nd. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of controversy, and this would be the thing that would stir up real controversy in Geekland. But because some server was placed kind of in connection status or something like that, they said it was the 40th anniversary of the Internet. So congratulations there to the net. I also saw that this is something I found interesting. There's a website that we talk about from time to time. Mike, KL7R, and I visited this website quite frequently and found it interesting. I still find it interesting. Every once in a while, the site will run a story about solder smoke or about some of the technology that we work on. It's called Hackaday. And they recently had their five years of Hackaday. I thought it had been around longer. It seems like such an established thing. But I guess, like most everything else on the web, it's all relatively new. So, congratulations to Hackaday for their fifth anniversary. And when I saw this, I started thinking, well, how long have we been doing solder smoke? And I checked, and we just passed our fourth anniversary. So we've had 4 years of solder smoke. Mike and I uploaded. I think Mike actually uploaded the first issue of Solder Smoke on August 21st, 2005. So here we are, 4 years. And, well, it's been a lot of fun. Let's see what else. See if I have any other anniversary things here. Looking down the list. No, I think that's it on the anniversary theme. But let me see here. So this is sort of related to the anniversary theme. One of our listeners sent in a very interesting NASA article about what's known as Carrington flares, named for a British solar astronomer, Richard Carrington. Carrington was one of the early solar astronomers, and apparently one day he was sitting there with his telescope aimed at the sun with the projection device. He wasn't looking through it, of course. That wouldn't have been good. But he had the projection device attached to the eyepiece, so it actually projects the picture of the sun onto almost like a screen. And he was watching some sunspots. And then all of a sudden, something really, really bright occurred. You got the impression that it almost kind of burned through the screen. And he was looking at a really massive, kind of scary solar flare, which became named for him, and it's known as a Carrington-class flare. And, well, apparently these things put out so much energy that they could knock us all off the air. Carrington was looking before anybody was on the air, but apparently they come around not too frequently, good thing, but anyway, it's a very different kind of solar flare, and Carrington was the one who discovered it. Greg, KC2DWF, was the one who sent this in, and what I really found interesting about the article was that further on down in the piece, and I have the link to it up on the Solder Smoke blog page, there was a discussion of other, not quite Carrington-class flares, but other big solar flares and other big bursts of solar activity over the last few years that have caused unusual phenomenon on Earth. And in the article, they just kind of casually mentioned that on August 4th, 1972, there was a really unusual solar flare that caused a lot of trouble here on Earth and apparently knocked out power and telephone communication, I think, in the state of Illinois. But it also produced aurora very far south in the United States, unusually south. Now, this made me think about kind of a really vivid childhood memory that I had that I've never really been able to explain until now. And I distinctly remember one summer evening, we were all out playing in the front yard of our house. There was some sort of, I remember it sort of connected with some sort of family social event. Like we had friends and relatives over, and all the kids were out at night. We were allowed to stay out longer than usual, and we were all kind of barefoot running around in the grass. And we looked up, and the sky was, the night sky was turning all kinds of colors. Now, I know what you're thinking. This was 1972, but no, there were no pharmaceutical involvement here. Too, we were very, very, very good kids, and very young. I was just 12 or 13, I guess. And anyway, it was really weird because there were all these, you know, bright lights, colors, purple, red, just seemed to be kind of rippling through the sky. And we tried to tell the adults about it, and they didn't really pay too much attention to us. They were involved in the social event. And so we stayed out, and we looked at it, and we all kind of wondered what it was. And over the years, I've occasionally thought about it. And I think I even mentioned it on Solder Smoke maybe once or twice. What the heck was that? It wasn't until I saw the article that Greg sent that I connected it. The timing is about right. My memories kind of made me think that I was younger than 13, but I guess that's about right. And but the time of the year is perfect, a midsummer night. It also fits for another reason, and I realized this. August 4th is my dad's birthday, and so there was probably a family celebration. August 4th, everybody was there. We were running around, and so that's probably what we saw. We probably saw aurora from this really strong solar event. And I did a little bit more searching on this, and there was another NASA site there that kind of addressed exactly my questions about what I remembered from childhood. And on the second NASA site, they said, many people have these kinds of memories from childhood, and here's a list of events over the last, I guess they provided going back pretty far, going back about 70 years or more. And they said, these are the events that are most likely to explain these kind of unusual aurora memories. And sure enough, there in the list, August 4th, 1972. So I think that's what it was, guys. I think we have cleared up that mystery, and it's of course anniversary related. There you go. And I wonder if anybody else remembers that one, the August 4th, 1972 aurora event, or any others. If anybody else has any kind of stories like that, send them in, and we'll we'll take a look. It was quite memorable and actually a lot of fun. And I'm glad that we've cleared that up. Gentlemen, this just leaves, I think, one major mystery in terms of my science and technology-related childhood memories. And I've mentioned this before, and I'm going to make another plea for help. When I was about 16 years old, so that would have been about 1975, 1974, I got a bout of of homebrew fever. The knack kicked in big time, and I decided that I really couldn't consider myself a true radio amateur. I couldn't consider myself among the truly anointed unless I built a real serious homebrew project on my own. And I had been told that the real challenge in this area was the receiver. I was told that lots of people built transmitters, and transmitters were supposedly easy, but that receivers, well, constructing and using your own receiver, well, that was the mark of a true radio wizard. And, wanting to have wizard status, I searched around and found a receiver project that I thought that I could handle. And I was wrong, of course. It was beyond my technical capabilities, but it came from a magazine article. I thought it was 73. It might have been Popular Electronics. It might have been some other magazine. I don't think it was QST. But the key feature to it was that it was varactor controlled. It had varactor diodes in it, and I remember that was part of the appeal to me. I kind of liked the varactor diode thing. I probably didn't have to worry about getting a variable capacitor, which might have been tough at the time. But a varactor-controlled receiver, I believe it was direct conversion, I think. West, W7ZOI, had launched the direct conversion revolution a few years earlier in his 1968 QST article. So it would have made sense. It would have been direct conversion receivers at the time would have been fairly popular. So if anybody can help me, I want to find the article, because I came really close to getting this thing working, heartbreakingly close in retrospect. I built the thing. I built it actually with a PC board. I actually etched the PC board. God knows what kind of pattern I used, because I can remember looking at the diagram and just seeing it as a whole mass of components and leads, and I didn't really have a sense of what was going on in the circuit. I really didn't even have a good sense of how to lay out a PC board and the need to keep, inputs away from outputs and watch out for unwanted feedback and things like that. Anyway, I put this whole thing together. It took me a long time, and I couldn't get it to work. And this was before the days of the internet, where you could just shoot out a message to QRPL and get all kinds of expert advice. There was none of that at the time. For some reason, I didn't turn to the local radio club. I should have, but I didn't. I'm sure there would have been somebody there at Crystal Radio Club, W2DMC, to help me. But kids do weird things, and I didn't do it. I didn't go there. And I just kind of got frustrated with it and let it go. Now, I realize now how, tantalizingly close I got to making this thing work, because I could remember sitting there trying to get it to work, and as I tuned the HT37, as I put my HT37 transmitter on spot and tuned the main oscillator, I would pick up signals, and I'd hear signals coming out of a little earphone of my homebrew receiver. So obviously what had happened was that I'd got everything in that receiver working except the local oscillator. The local oscillator wasn't oscillating. And of course, that's kind of a showstopper in a direct conversion receiver. So if I had just gotten that oscillator going, I could have, at the age of 15 or 16, been in the ranks of the truly anointed homebrew knack-afflicted radio wizards. So anyway, what I want to do is I want to take another shot at it. I want to build this receiver. I want to build it now, but I can't find the article. I've gone through several rounds of trying to find this thing, and nobody can find it. The guys have searched all kinds of archives and indexes and everything else, but I know there's somebody out there. There's some pack rat out there. We're all pack rats, but there's some real pack rat out there who's got boxes and stacks of these magazines. Maybe somebody has an index. Maybe somebody can look it up. Again, the key feature varactor controlled. I was working on this probably 1973, 1974, maybe 1975. The article could have come out earlier. I might have been dealing with an old magazine that I'd picked up someplace, but it couldn't have been much earlier than 1968 because Wes's article on direct conversion receivers didn't come out until, I think, November 1968. So somewhere in that period, in some ham radio magazine, this article came out about build your own direct conversion. I don't even know if they had direct conversion in the title. Again, the key feature was varactor controlled. And if anybody can find this article and send it to me, I wanna take another shot at it. I wanna finish this project even after, what is it now, 35 or 40 years or something like that. Anyway, so if you can help me out with that would be great. Let's see. Speaking of here, I guess this also is on the anniversary theme or the old-time radio theme. Wes sent to me a really excellent link to a great website called the Transistor Museum, a real treasure trove of information. Wes was alerted to it by Jeff Dam, WA7MLH, the guy who built a lot of the circuits for solid-state design and the radio amateur, solid-state design for the radio amateur. And Jeff and Wes are still in contact. Jeff's got a really great website. You can just search for it. And really amazing stuff on his website. We talked about it. We talk about it from time to time. But the Transistor Museum, and you'll see the link on the Solder Smoke blog, really a nice piece of work. And I think everybody who's interested in this kind of stuff will find something of interest there, especially some of the kind of the people who are really into the old transistors. Mike AA1TJ will like this thing, the Transistor Museum. Check out the link. It's up on the Solder Smoke blog at soldersmoke.blogspot.com. All right, let's see what else we got going. Well, I mentioned the Country House, and this is my work at the Ponticelli Astronomical Observatory and QRP station. I have out at the house I left my telescope out there because the telescope is pretty useless in Rome, but very helpful out there at the country place. And we have neighbors at the country place, friends from Rome, who also have taken an apartment out there. And last weekend we were out and took the telescope out. It was full moon, so the full moon. I tried to explain to these folks that the full moon is really the enemy of serious amateur astronomers, but they thought it was great, and we just put the telescope on the full moon and looked at that, had a good time with that. Also put the telescope on Jupiter. Jupiter is really bright in the evening sky now. It's the brightest thing in the evening sky with the exception of the moon, and really big, and we had the telescope on Jupiter. Interesting because a recent issue of Discover magazine has a really nice article about NASA's upcoming mission to Europa. Now, Europa is one of the four Galilean moons that Galileo Galilei discovered. The article points out that there was some quite a bit of discussion about what they should call these moons. And Galileo's first thought was to name it for his kind of rich Italian patron, the Medici family. He was being bankrolled by the Medicis, so he wanted to call them the Medici moons or something like that. Stay in the good graces of the folks who were writing the checks. And then there was some other discussion about who they should be named for. There was some discussion about who actually should get credit for discovering them. But in the end, of course, they went with naming them for Galileo. They're all really interesting, but they think right now, I guess the most interesting one is Europa, because the idea is that Europa's got a liquid ocean underneath its ice crust. And NASA is planning to send a probe there. I think the launch date is sometime around 2020. It's going to be a really big, really expensive probe. and it'll get there, if everything goes according to plan, by 2026. I was kind of disappointed because I don't think, as I read the article, I don't think that they're actually going to send a probe to the surface. This is going to stay in orbit around Europa and study it from orbit. I mean, I know they had had some discussion about sending something down to the surface and maybe having it melt its way through the ice and then, you know, go into submarine mode and take some pictures about what's down there in the water, which would be really cool. Apparently, Arthur C. Clarke, you know, followed up on Europa in Space Odyssey 2010, not the 2001, but 2010, the sequel. And apparently, we get a message from the Europa people or the Europa beings, and it's something like, "All these other worlds are for you, but make no landings on Europa." Well, anyway, which apparently with this mission, it's just going to go into orbit, and that, I think the European Space Agency is going to carry out sort of a parallel mission, and they're going to go to one of the other Galilean satellites, the to Ganymede. You know, these four little moons around Jupiter, they're really a lot of fun to watch with a small telescope. Because you can see the move quite quickly. You know, you come back, you take a look at Jupiter, you come back an hour or so later, and they've moved. The astronomy magazines publish kind of little charts where you could take a look and see exactly what the configuration is at any given time. A Sky and Telescope magazine has an online kind of Jupiter-Moon chart, and you could just go online and see which one is where. Makes it fun, and then you can, when you're showing your friends the Galilean moons through your telescope, you can impress them by saying, "Ah, yes, the one off to the left is Io, and that one there on the right, well, that's Callisto," things like that. I as you know, I get into occasional bouts of astronomy, and I guess I'm in one right now because I've published a few stories, astronomy related stories, up on the blog, and somebody wrote in and said, "Hey, yeah, but what does this have to do with us?" When I said, "Well, you know, I electromagnetic waves coming in from far, far away, real DX, you know, it's, you know, some of the gear that you need to pick up the signals. I know it's a bit of a stretch, but I guess there is a connection there." And that brings me to something else that I put up on the blog, the Hubble Space Telescope. I'm sure you guys have seen these pictures. They were in the newspapers. They made a lot of front pages last week. But the results of the repair mission on Hubble Space Telescope have been released, and they are spectacular. Really great pictures. I've always been a big fan of Hubble Space Telescope. When I was in Santo Domingo, because we were close to the equator, and because the telescope is in a kind of near equatorial orbit, in just about every pass, this thing goes around the Earth every 90 minutes, and I'd be out there in the front yard of my house in Santo Domingo, and this big bright aluminum thing with solar panels would fly over, and I could see it just about every morning if I didn't pay attention. Sometimes it was really noticeable because it's really bright, and so the sun would be below the horizon, but Hubble was up high enough so it would be illuminated, and it would be this big kind of bright star coming over, and with a very distinct satellite movement. So anyway, this was early days of the internet too, but sometimes I'd go into the house and connect to the CompuServe server in Miami, a very expensive internet connection from Santo Domingo, but I couldn't resist, and then I would download some of the latest pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope, and it was all very kind of cool and early internetish and astronomical. So anyway, they've gone up, they've fixed up Hubble, and it's working great, and they're getting all kinds of great images from it. And so I put a story up about this up on the blog at soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Check it out. Pictures are there. What's really cool is there's a link to a really nice video in which they show the scientists when they were getting their first view through the new the new improved device, and it's really interesting to see their reactions and their discussions of the technical aspects of the project and all. And so I said I think that provided further connection to the solder smoke homebrew NAC community. These are really weak signals, so they're weak after this long journey. So it's vaguely QRP-ish, and we sent guys up there. They fixed this thing. They made some repairs. They made some modifications. Always part of our world. So there you go. Those are the connections. And well, heck, it's my blog, and if I want to put Hubble on there, I'm going to do it. All right, let's see. We talked about the mission to Europa. Ponticelli. I talked about the Astronomical Observatory. Now the QRP station, that's going very well too. I have the HW8 out there. I must say I felt a little bit uneasy about leaving the HW8 unattended. It's locked up and everything, but I didn't feel like carting it back and forth to Rome every time we go out there. So it's out there. I have a little table set up on the front porch. I have an antenna up in the tree. I need to do some antenna work here, guys. My antenna is just wires thrown up into the tree, and I know I could do better. So I think I'm going to go out this morning before we head out to the country and buy some more AC zip cord. I have some 300-ohm twin lead, and I have the little antenna tuner that I bought at the Trastevere flea market. It seems to be working pretty well. It does a good job at tuning up. It's a little Pi network tuner, and it does a pretty good job of tuning up the kind of the end-fed wires. But what I think I might do is throw together some sort of doublet. I have a really nice little center connector for a doublet antenna for use with open wire feeder, and I just might put up some open wire feeder and put up a little doublet antenna and run it down to the antenna tuner and see how we can do with that. I've been on 40 meters and 20 meters, and I make a few contacts, but I think I could do better with a better antenna, of course. So that might be the project for Ponticelli this weekend. We're going to head back out. It might be warm enough today for the kids to get another weekend in the pool. Rome has really cooled off considerably, man. It's like they throw a switch at the end of August. It's just blazing hot and uncomfortable the end of August, and all of a sudden it's as if they decide that it's going to get comfortable in early September. So it's really nice now, and so we'll hopefully enjoy it. That's what's been happening out there at the Ponticelli Astronomical Observatory and QRP station. All right, let's see what else to talk about. Stuff from the mail. The mailbag. Well, I won't get into the mailbag. We got to wait for the mailbag. But I got the Antique Electronic Supply catalog came in the mail. Always fun. Always all kinds of good stuff in there for us. All kinds of good parts and old parts and new parts and books and kits and everything else. So that's been good. Hey, I've been reading Popular Mechanics a lot. Billy really likes Popular Mechanics. He likes Pop Sci better, but Popular Mechanics catches my eye every once in a while. And the recent issue has the Mythbusters guys on the cover. And they talk about the history of Mythbusters and the origins of Mythbusters and how they make the episodes and how these guys organize their workshops, workbenches, not only in the actual facility where they shoot the show, but also at home, what they have at home. And really interesting, Jamie and Adam, the two Mythbusters guys. And they also talk about the influence that the show is having on young people, that a lot of people they watch the show. It's very popular. It's doing quite well, millions and millions of viewers. And they say it's having the effect of exposing lots of young people to science and home construction and building things. And so, well, three cheers for the Mythbusters guys. We always enjoy that show. All kinds of cool stuff on there. And we catch it whenever we can here on the local cable TV system. I check out that Popular Mechanics article. I don't have it now. I had it in here, but I think Billy spotted it and took it and was reading it in his room. I didn't want to wake him up this morning, so I'll talk more about this later on. But really really kind of interesting stuff in the Pop Mechanics article about Mythbusters. Speaking about these kinds of shows, I wanted to mention something I caught on one of these kind of other Discovery Channel. I think it's a Discovery Channel or National Geographic Channel shows. We get them over here, and we can watch them in English or we can watch them in Italian. There was something there that was really interesting. One of these kind of mad scientist shows. Sometimes they get a little bit silly, and they have this show in the UK called Brainiac. And it seemed to have started out as a science show, but it sort of degenerated into an anti-science show. And they like to, you know, put things in microwave ovens that explode, and then they blow it up. And they love to blow up garden sheds by, you know, igniting propane cylinders and things like that. Or they drop things from great heights and see how squished they get. And it seems almost kind of anti-science. But there's still a number of good shows like this. The Mythbusters among them is quite good, of course. But I just was in the living room the other day. The kids had the TV on, and they were watching this show where this mad scientist kind of guy said that he was going to calculate the speed of light by using a microwave oven and a plate of cheese. And I said, wait a second, I got to see this thing. So he takes a plate of cheese, kind of ground up cheese, Parmesan or something like that, spreads it out on the on a little glass tray, and he opens up the microwave oven and he removes the, you know, the thing that causes the plate to rotate. He takes out the kind of, I guess it's not like the rotisserie or the lazy Susan that spins the thing around. Takes that out because he says it's very important to leave the plate of cheese in a fixed position. Puts it there. Then, you know, he sets the thing and he you know, selects a appropriate amount of time and he fires up the microwave oven. He leaves the plate there. He leaves it in there for 30 seconds or so and pulls it out. And then he says, look, look. And sure enough, on the plate of cheese, you could see two kind of stripes where the cheese has kind of melted or burned a little bit, where it got hot, and the other areas where it didn't get quite so hot and didn't melt or burn. Anyway, you can see this two distinct stripes there. And he says, yeah, you know, that the reason that they have the rotator in there is because inside the microwave oven, the microwaves create standing waves, and the standing waves cause uneven heating. So normally we'd want the thing to rotate because so you can get even heating when you're cooking up your, you know, your top ramen or whatever it is. But in this experiment, of course, we want the standing waves to be visible because they give us the opportunity to measure the size of the wave. Okay, so he takes a look and he measures the size of the wave, and it comes out to, like, I don't know, 3 centimeters or something like that. And then he says, all right, so now we know the size of the wave. He said, now we need to know the frequency. So he spins the microwave around, and on the back of the microwave it says something like, you know, that this device is operating at 2.4 gigahertz. Aha. So I'm thinking, yeah, he's got it. If he's got the size of the wave, if you know the size of the wave and you know the frequency of the wave, well, then you just do some quick division and it should give you the elusive C, the speed of light. He pulls out a calculator and zing, zing, zing. And yeah, he comes up with a figure that's pretty close to the speed of light. I thought that was pretty cool. I wonder what you guys think of that. Can you calculate the speed of light using a microwave oven and a plate of cheese? Anyway, yeah, the science TV. You see, we got a lot of competition here on Solder Smoke. Let's see. Okay, after I put all these shows on about the astronomy stuff, I did get some reader feedback saying, hey Bill, let's get back to the radios. Oh yeah, one other thing I forgot. This is one of the articles that I put up there on astronomy that provoked one of these comments about, because it's about comets. There's this guy in Australia named Rob McNaught. And Rob McNaught, I don't think, is a radio amateur. I hoped he was. He should be. But I don't think he is. But he's a scientist at a at an astronomical observatory in New South Wales, about 400 kilometers from Sydney, Australia, called the Sliding Spring Observatory. This is the guy, one of these guys who has a really, really cool job from the perspective of a radio amateur, knack victim, a home brewer, science-interested person. Gosh, this guy's got a good job. The Sliding Spring Observatory is one of the few observatories in the world that has been tasked with finding, identifying, and cataloging kind of worrisome near-Earth objects. These are the big chunks of rock and ice that are floating around out there. Comets, too, that could, another thing that could put us all off the air and out of existence. Rob McNaught and a few of his colleagues out there, 400 kilometers outside Sydney in New South Wales, have as their job to search the sky with a telescope. I think it's a 1.5 meter diameter, 50 centimeter meter, 50 centimeter telescope. They search the skies with this thing, and they look for these kind of worrisome objects, and they catalog it. So, I mean, you talk about, I mean, yeah, I joked on the blog page. I put this all up on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. I said, man, the hours don't look too good because it's all obviously night work, I guess, or maybe not. Maybe if they're working off photographic plates. But I said, the hours might not be good, but talk about the job satisfaction. Can you imagine there, you know, going off to work this morning thinking, it's me that's going to save the world. To find that really worrisome, you know, mountainous object that's on our way, and then launch the effort to divert it or something like that, to save the planet. So it's got to have really high job satisfaction. It's also got an amazing fringe benefit, because as Rob McNaught and his one or two colleagues go through and search for these worrisome objects, they also have the opportunity to spot new comets. And, of course, spotting comets is really good because you get them named after you. If you discover it, it becomes the Comet McNaught. I always wanted the Comet Mara. But, no, I've never found one. But, anyway, Rob has found his 50th, and this is a record. He's found 50 of them. And I guess this comes as a result of, well, not only his eagle eye and his persistence, but as a fringe benefit to his work on the effort to save the planet and humanity. It's really cool. I thought this was a really cool cool job to have. And so the story of Rob McNaught and the Sliding Spring Observatory is up on the latest edition of the Solder Smoke blog. I think you guys will get a kick out of that. Let's see what else here. What else we got? We did that calculating C with the pizza. The HST picture. All right. Anyway, so I got the Sliding Spring Observatory up there. We did the Hubble Space Telescope. The mail starts coming in saying it's time to get back to radio. So I did. Anyway, you know, I've talked here many times about my struggles with mixer theory, my sense that trigonometry is just not quite enough in understanding how mixers operate. My search for the kind of intuitive, true wizard understanding of a radio circuit that Gene Shepard would have been searching for. A couple guys wrote in, Mike, KC7IT, and Dennis, W6DWF, both wrote in about a new book, looks like a really good book, on RF circuits that has come out. And I was supposed to write down the name of the book, but I didn't. But that's why we have a blog, gentlemen. That's why we have a blog. Anyway, it's up on the blog, and it's under an article called Mixing It Up. Mike points out that there's a really good diagram in there that shows very graphically how a mixer takes two frequencies and combines them to produce some and different frequencies. A lot of times in the books and in the handbooks, when you get to this point and you're wondering, okay, how is it that when you take two frequencies and stick them into a mixer, you end up with some and difference frequencies? And why is it that they describe this as multiplication? Why is it that if a mixer multiplies, it comes up with some and difference frequencies? How does that work? Well, in most of the books, they just give you a bunch of trigonometry. And they say, well, you know, the sines and the cosines, when you add them together, you can see in the mathematical formula, the output includes some and difference frequencies. Okay, I believe you. I know it's true. But why? How? How does that work? What's going on here? Anyway, the picture in this new book that Mike, KC7IT, alerted me to, gives a real good graphical, kind of intuitive sense of how this all comes together, and also how multiplication, and it really is best described mathematically as multiplication, does produce the sum and difference frequencies. I have it all up on the blog. Check it out. I think you guys will find it interesting. And rest assured that we're not going to permanently drift off into outer space on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com blog or on this podcast. All right, let's see what else we have here. I'm going through my list. I think that might be it. Oh, one thing I want to announce. I said a while back that, well, two things I want to announce. That I said a while back that I was going to take down the Solder Smoke coffee mug bumper sticker and t-shirt store, and I said I had to take it down because it cost me like $6 a month to keep it in operation, and our income has normally been about $4 a month. So not a lot of big bucks in this operation, but I actually, a little bit of work went into designing all these mugs and t-shirts and everything else. It was fun, it was easy, but I thought, well, it's a shame. Let's take another shot at it. So I went to Cafe Press and I found a way to reduce the prices on these items. I realized that some of them might have been a bit pricey, and that might have turned people away. I'm reluctant to spend, $20 on a t-shirt or something like that, or $25 for a hat. So anyway, I went, and we've had some significant price reductions. I found a way to do it. The prices are now reduced. I guess we'll call this the Solder Smoke Fall T-shirt Bumper Sticker and Coffee Mug Sale. If you go to the Blogspot, soldersmoke.blogspot.com page, in the upper left you'll see a little coffee mug. Click on the mug. That'll take you to the store, and you'll find all the new reduced prices in our fall sale. Bumper stickers, for example, are now no longer around $6. They're now around $3. And you can ride around in your car with a bumper sticker that proudly tells the world that your other vehicle was home-brewed using junk box parts. Things like that. It'll help you find other Solder Smoke fiends. People will approach you in parking lots and say, yeah, I too listen to Solder Smoke. I am with you. All right. Anyway, check it out. The other thing I want to mention, hey, why isn't this show being transmitted on shortwave radio? We've had a couple guys who have taken it. It's playing on 2-meter repeaters in Tasmania, and I'm grateful for that. Other folks have taken it and put it on cable systems in retirement communities. We're happy about that. But wouldn't it be appropriate for the Solder Smoke Show, which is all really about shortwave radio, to be transmitted on a shortwave broadcast station? There are stations out there now that are carrying Solder Smoke, amateur radio-related blog, podcasts. I think This Week in Amateur Radio is carried by the shortwave broadcast station WBCQ up there in Maine. I would really like Solder Smoke to be broadcast on the shortwave bands. This means folks out there in all corners of the earth could listen to the show even if they don't have internet access. It could join the ranks of HCJB and Radio Havana Cuba. in carrying radio-related shows. Some of you guys must have connections, must have friends who work in these stations. Please help me out here. Send me an email. How can we get Solder Smoke onto the shortwave broadcast bands? Legally, preferably legally. Legally would be preferable. Anyway, let me know. If you have any ideas, WBCQ or any of the other stations that might be interested in carrying what would be essentially free programming, quality programming, but at an extremely reasonable cost. All right, let's see. Time for...
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
I love
them. Indeed.
Yeah, Solder Smoke Mailbag. All right, let's see. Tim Walford sent me his latest edition of his Construction Club newsletter, Hot Iron. Always glad to receive that. Thanks a lot, Tim. And it's great. I fold it up. I stick it in my pocket. And when I go wait for the kids at the bus stop or something, get a few minutes to read Hot Iron. Great projects. Always good. Always glad to get Hot Iron. Thanks for that. Let's see what else we have here. Really good mail. I got from Steve Hartley, G0FUW, a video on the Bath Build-A-Thon, a DVD all about the Bath Build-A-Thon. And I have, Steve, I haven't fired it up yet, but I'm going to. And I'm going to talk more about this in later editions. Thanks very much. Also from the UK, I was very pleased to get a very nice gift from Andrew Atkinson, G4CWX, who sent in a gift. Andrew is a really interesting guy. We're very lucky to have him in the amateur radio ranks. He is a very successful author. He had the kind of career that really sets you up for a post-retirement career as a writer of crime fiction. I'll read you Andrew's bio here from the inside of his new book, Killer Email, by Andrew Atkinson, published by Pegasus Publishers, www.pegasuspublishers.com. You can get his book there. But Andrew Atkinson was, for many years, a police officer working within a variety of departments in New Scotland Yard and the Home Office. For the past 12 years, he has been a successful international IT consultant working with major financial and technology-based institutions around the world. In his spare time, Andrew enjoys flying light aircraft and has obtained licenses in Europe, Africa, and America. Whenever possible, he enjoys scuba diving. He is a licensed radio amateur and a free man of the City of London. Andrew can be contacted via www.AndrewAtkinson, that's one word, www.andrewatkinson.org, where news of his other books may also be found. Anyway, I'm really looking forward to reading this book. Billy has his eye on it too, Andrew, and I think I might have to fight him for this. It's really cool because it's got a lot of things related to kind of our lifestyle. I'll read you the excerpt on the back. A young man's body is found on a deserted street in Boston early one morning. Unexpectedly, he is not a vagrant, but appears to have died of natural causes, a previously undiagnosed condition suddenly making its presence felt. To Police Lieutenant Chip Davenport, it just seems like another routine, if sad, story. That Ian Hall is a junior researcher for the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office seems little more than a minor diplomatic inconvenience. Senior FCO investigator, FCO, very significant letters for me, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. For those of you on the other side of the Atlantic from the UK, that's basically their equivalent of the State Department, the hallowed halls of the FCO, spent many days there. Senior FCO investigator Tony Caxton is assigned to tie up the loose ends of the diplomatic incident. Outwardly, it seems a minor case. Hall's investigation into international banking and money transfer systems was low-level and barely beyond the research stage, but Caxton is troubled by the circumstances of his former colleague's death. Slowly, a darkening picture of greed, conspiracy, and corruption emerges. Who is reading your email? Oh, man, there you go. Looks like a page-turner. I think it's got some ham radio in it, too. Looking forward to reading that. Thanks very much, Andrew. Let's see what else we got here. Da-da-da. All right, that gets us to the email portion of the show here. Here's a really interesting one. Jack, NP2OR, responds to my plea for to our plea for grabber stations in other parts of the world. I think it's WA5DJJ wrote in and said that we need grabber stations for QRSS signals or in South America, Asia, and Africa. Jack, NP2OR, points out that he is moving to Uganda. A work assignment is going to take him to Uganda, to Kampala. And he has offered to help out in this regard and offers to set up some sort of African grabber or whisper station. One of the problems is that he says he's not going to have really good internet access. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be through a cell phone network. So that might be a showstopper for a receive system. But I was thinking that perhaps Jack could set up a transmitter there and let the rest of us see if we can pick up signals from Uganda. He's going to be moving in 2 months. So he might not realize it yet, but he's going to be getting into the frantic I'm about to move time period. He might not have a lot of time to set up a transmitter. If anybody has a spare QRSS transmitter that they can or whisper transmit system that they could give to Jack, he could take it with him and we could have a station on the air from Kampala. Very interesting. Let's see. David, M0VTG, reports that for him the knack is back. It had been interrupted for many years, but he's back, and he gives Solder Smoke the credit for bringing it back. It was interrupted by preparations for a de-expedition to Papua New Guinea, and he had planned on taking the book with him, but he stopped to read Solder Smoke the book, and that I hope it didn't delay the expedition to Papua New Guinea. I hope the book made it to Papua New Guinea. And he sent us some really nice pictures about old crystals and that were used in the early part of the 20th century in radio receivers that you could buy commercially in the UK. And I thought it was really interesting that these crystals were packaged in boxes that look remarkably like Altoid tins. You know, Altoid's the curiously refreshing mint from the United Kingdom. UK knack victims seem to be especially prone towards a kind of a related malady that we're calling Altoidism, which is the urge to build radio devices inside Altoid's tins. And the pictures that David sent along, which I've put up on the blog, are a reminder that Altoidism may have a very deep roots indeed in the United Kingdom. Check it out. Dave, a VE7CQY, is a retired electrical engineer. He's the guy who I thought was away from the hobby for quite some time, and said after retiring from his career in electrical engineering, he had adopted kind of an anti-technology attitude, but Solder Smoke has brought him back to the knack. And now he is up early in the morning playing with LT Spice, so I joked with him that we're glad that Solder Smoke has brought him back to the knack and has put some spice in his life. Bum-bum. There you go. Thanks very much for writing in. Yoger, who said that I'm pronouncing his name right, has LA1NOA, has written in to tell me that he doesn't think that regens are actually from, as he put it, the warm place. You'll recall that I had commented recently about the possible diabolical nature of regenerative receivers. He says no, he doesn't think they are from the warm place. Yoger, don't be fooled. They are all possessed. They may cooperate with you for a while, but if you change the antenna, if the wind blows, something else goes wrong, the demonic aspects of these receivers will immediately become apparent. Even happy, friendly Norwegian regen receivers, I'm sure, have this characteristic. They are possessed and they will eventually turn on you. Howard Armstrong invented the superhet for very good reasons. All right, Roger, K7RXV. Really liked my stories about the Chingali, the wild boars, and he recommends the short stories of Patrick McManus. And they have titles like When the Bear Ate Goomba. These are all camping stories, short stories with titles like When the Bear Ate Goomba, and I like the second one, Real Ponies Don't Oink. Indeed, when you're out there in Sabina, as we are and will be, and you hear that kind of sound, you know, you might try to kid yourself into thinking that that's some other kind of animal, but no, man, that's the Chingali. Anyway, back we go. Jeff, KO7M, our friend, this is the lucky guy with two kinds of cubs, the Piper Cub and the MFJ Cub. Apparently Jeff is taking both of them on a fly through the Pacific Northwest. He's heading out to Idaho. He's going to be landing the plane and camping out under the wing. Man, doesn't that sound good? I told him to watch out for the Chingali. He was confused, and I had to explain what I was talking about. He's building 35-watt linear amplifiers using IRF 510s and is having good results with them. I told him that he's having better luck than I had, because I had nothing but tales of woe from my adventures with the MOSFET transistors. But Jeff is apparently having good luck. We'll get some more info from him. And good luck with this weekend's travel through the Pacific Northwest with the Piper Cub. He said he's got to get some flying in before the bad weather keeps him grounded. Lito, LU1MPC, is listening in from Mendoza, Argentina. Thanks very much. Mads, LA1TPA, points out that in a recent episode of The World This Week in Amateur Radio, which is carried by WBCQ, I'm envious in reporting, said that they recently carried the audio portion of the famous Dilbert video, in which he is diagnosed with the knack. So, all right. I'm glad to hear that. And we already talked about Andrew's book and Steve's Bath Build-A-Thon video. Guys, that brings us to the end. We're at the hour point, almost perfect. Listen, take one final plea here. Solder Smoke, the book. Don't forget. It's available. You can see the link there in the upper right hand of the blog page. Or you can go to Amazon and just search for Solder Smoke. It'll take you there. Guys are writing in with improvements, and the book is just about every week improved and improving. But it's selling pretty well. Guys are really enjoying it. I'm getting a lot of feedback. And if you're looking for something to read, keep the Solder Smoke, a global adventure in radio electronics, in mind. It's available from lulu.com or, like I said, through amazon.com. You can very easily find it in the upper right-hand corner of the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. That's it for this week. 7-3s from Rome.